It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Organic describes something derived from living matter, but it's also a philosophy. And Rodale Institute's Executive Director Jeff Moyer knows organic philosophy. He knows organic farming like nobody else. And he's our guest today on Farm to Table Talk. Jeff, welcome. It's good to visit with you.
Thank you, Roger. It's a real pleasure to be with you and with your listeners.
Jeff, a lot of my listeners are either big fans of organic, or they, in some cases, they buy organic when they can, and some of the farmers are kind of moving that direction. You're situated in a program that is answering questions of consumers and helping farmers transition, and you've been doing it for a long time. And I'm tempted to say that before organic was in fashion, but that's not quite true, because organic was in fashion for my grandfather's days, so that's the only way you could farm, you know, back in the early 1900s. You know, Jeff, I remember when organics were getting started, and the critics were saying, there are two things I thought they felt, was that they felt like when you bought, you know, fruit or vegetables, that they could see more insect damage, and so the people that were kind of being critical of organic were, that was one thing they pointed to. And then the other thing that often came up was that yields were so much different. And so they would say, sure, you could grow organic, but your yields are going to be so much lower, you're not going to be able to stay in business. And I'm sure there are others, but I can just remember, especially in the early days, that people used to say that. I don't know if that's still being said, or if you can, how have you addressed those kind of criticisms?
Well, I think some people are still saying that, of course, but it's just not true. I think any short trip to the supermarket will show you that the quality of organic product on the shelf is equal to, or in some cases even possibly superior to, that of conventionally produced food. So it's not, there's no, consumers are not being asked to buy or support through their purchasing power substandard product.
Well, can I stop you there, though? Let me just stop you there for a second. But would it be true, though, that when it was getting started, that people were still learning how to do a better job and use all of the things that they can do now with organics, and perhaps at first the quality wasn't quite as good, and it's improved over these last 30 years?
Well, I think the goal of all farmers, whether they're conventional or organic, is to continuously improve the quality of the product that they bring to the consumer. And I would suggest that probably what you're saying in organic is as true as in conventional, that the product continuously gets better. There may have been some farmers who were not up to par in the production strategy as they went to organic. And we've seen that happen where farmers who are not particularly good managers think that organic, because of the price premium, is somehow going to save their farm. And what we find out is they typically are even less successful as organic farmers and don't stay in the business very long, because consumers just aren't going to support that in the marketplace, nor should they. The other thing, factor that happens, of course, is over the last 30 or 40 years, we've done a lot of research, and so we've developed more tools, more production strategies to help farmers produce high-quality yields and high-quality product, regardless of what they're producing. And that's true about, again, conventional or organic, is that we keep doing research to make things better, and we do that in the organic world as well.
Jeff, have you done side-by-side comparisons in similar areas of having conventional production right next to an organic production, so that people could come and see for themselves what the differences are?
Yeah, not only does Rodale do that, but several other agencies are doing that as well. Back in 1981, the Rodale Institute started its first side-by-side comparison of organic and conventional, looking at grain production. That experiment still exists, so we're now in our 39th year of comparing conventional and organic in a side-by-side experimental research trials. And, you know, that experiment, our farming systems trial, is probably the most cited data in the world looking at the comparison of organic and conventional. And we've had many land-grant universities doing satellite trials on those plots and delving deep into the minutiae around experimental design and what's really happening there. But about 18 years, I think it was, after we started that experiment, the USDA started their own experiments, side-by-side comparison at their Beltsville, Maryland research station. What's really been exciting for us is the results that we found. They basically found the same thing as they look at comparing conventional organic, and that is that organic agriculture helps us as farmers mitigate the impacts of climate change and smooth out the highs and lows of production across fluctuating weather patterns. They both documented that yields can be very comparable if you're under good management, and so that's been exciting. And they've also all kind of shown that the health of the soil changes and improves under organic management strategies. University of Wisconsin also has a long-term side-by-side comparison study. Iowa State has one, and I believe there's one at UC Davis out in California. Now, all of those folks work together on those plots. They compare notes and information both professionally at conferences like the Tri-Society meetings with the agronomy folks, the soil folks, and the horticulture folks. And then in, I think it was 2016, Rodale Institute initiated a vegetable systems trial where we're also comparing organic and conventional production strategies with vegetables. But in this case, we're looking at human consumables and the impact that farm production strategies have on human health. So, yeah, lots of side-by-side projects going on around the country, and a lot of great science happening there. Help farmers and also help consumers.
Yeah, tell me about the connections on human health. What are you learning? What are you finding out so far?
Well, that particular experiment is relatively new. But one of the things that we have found out is that there are differences in across production strategies in the amount of ergothionine that's in the soil and in the food that the soil produces. That's kind of interesting because most of us as farmers in particular, we don't think much about ergothionine production. And in fact, until we started looking at that, I didn't even know what ergothionine was. But it turns out it's an amino acid that helps the human body fight off certain cancers and certain neurological diseases. And those neurological diseases are things like autism, attention deficit disorder, and Alzheimer's disease. What do we see on the rise, of course, across the country, is more and more of those sorts of neurological diseases showcasing themselves in our society. Is there a link between that and the way we manage the soil? Well, we're trying to find out, because it looks on the surface like there is, but it takes a lot more science and research to find that out.
Say what that enzyme is again. What's that called?
It's called, and don't ask me to spell it.
Oh, right. Shoot, that's what I was going to do next.
The speller in the world, but I can do it if I write it down. It's called ergo, It's E-R-G-O, thionine, T-H-I-N-O-I-N-E.
Now,
it's an amino acid.
Okay.
Anybody can Google that or...
And is the production of that enzyme, is that directly related to the microbiome, to the microbial health of the soil and the microbes in the soil that's organic versus conventional?
Yes. We've known that ergothionine exists since about 1907, but we weren't sure how it was produced. And we still don't understand how it moves within the plant cycle. And it turns out that it's only produced by funguses in the soil and certain bacteria that act like funguses within the soil. There are certain mushrooms that can produce it as well. But it's really produced in the soil by soil funguses. So the two things that really impact ergothionine production are tillage. So the more tillage you do, the less ergothionine, and then pesticides like Roundup that kill the bacteria and the funguses in the soil. That's not why we apply them as conventional farmers, and I'm the first one to admit that. We don't apply them, and the farmer's goal is never to try and destroy soil funguses. That's just a side effect of some of these herbicides. So you're killing off some of the funguses and some of the bacteria that act like funguses, thereby reducing ergothionine production. Again, infantile research, we're just scratching the surface of the, but it's really exciting information.
What universities are doing the research? I'm just curious.
Well, Rodale's doing the research right now, and we're working closely with Penn State University.
Great.
But there are some other universities beginning to sign on and look at that work because it's fascinating. And we're also working with Penn State Hershey Medical Center to look at some of the impacts that ergothionine can have on human health.
Well, and there's antibiotic resistant or treatment resistant to funguses that are apparently starting to become a big concern across the country too. And there's some questions of whether or not the use of fungicides are a contributing factor.
Correct.
So that it's an emerging area. It's one that we'll have to keep track of. And that's the other thing.
Well, then we're also looking at nutrient density and nutrient levels in different foods that the soil is producing, knowing that some crops can produce vitamins from sunlight, but for the most part, the vitamin and mineral content of the food we eat is directly related to the vitamin and mineral nutrients in the soil. So if the soil is depleted in those nutrients or can't mineralize them in the right way, then they're not in the food. If they're not in the food, then they're not in us. And so we're seeing direct correlations there as well to the amount of nutrition that's really in the food. So it's not just a question of producing tons of broccoli or sweet corn or pick any vegetable you like or don't like. It's really what amount of nutritional value is in there. Because if all we're eating is nutritionally deficient carrots, for example, it's not as good as eating nutrient-dense carrots. And so those are things we're beginning to look at.
It's interesting because we're talking about those things that you can't really see, you can't measure, you're looking at testing them and so forth. But I keep going back to a picture I have in my mind of things you can see. And I remember seeing some of those pictures of side-by-side trials that Rodale was on so many years ago, where soils next to one field next to another, one soil had looked very, very dark and black, and the right next to it looked very gray, you know, and it was the same little piece of the earth.
Well, I think that's really, really important to farmers, to scientists, of course, but also to farmers to know that the way they manage the soil can have a direct impact on their success as a farmer and their ability to hand over to the next generation a soil that's in better condition than when they got it. And I think we all want to do that, doesn't matter what type of farmer you are. And this kind of research enables us to do that, and organic practices enable us to do that.
You know, Jeff, one of the things I think of, I can go back to the farm I grew up on in central Illinois, and when I was a kid, every time I wanted to go fishing, I could go stick a spade in the ground and get all kinds of earthworms to be able to go fishing with. You're lucky to get any today.
And that's just because of the way we farm. It's not because we farm. It's because of the way we farm. So we're not asking folks to give up agriculture. We know that's not a solution. How do we begin to change the way we manage the soil so that those earthworms come back and are there in abundance, so that the food we produce is there and in abundance, so the nutritional quality of that food is there and in abundance? I think that's what we're really working towards.
Jeff, I have to ask you this. It seems like there's been a huge amount of progress, and you at Rodale have been leading so many of these efforts. But it seems like when things are going well, here you are kind of some would say, messing with a good thing, because people are getting used to organic, and you're adding another term. You're adding regenerative organic. Kind of what does that mean, and why is it necessary to start drawing attention to regenerative organic?
Well, sure. We're excited to talk about that. And I'm sure to some folks it does feel like, boy, we just about are catching up in the idea of organic, and now you're going ahead and moving the needle or changing the the dial a little bit to include the word regenerative. And that really started for us back in the late 1970s and early 1980s when J.I. Rodale's son, Robert Rodale, began looking at what was happening with the organic movement and suggesting that we could do better than just think about eliminating synthetic pesticides and salt-based fertilizers and that sort of thing, and start thinking more about the long-term regenerative capacity of the soil. So Rodale Institute and Robert Rodale, and we've never used the word sustainable. Sustainable is a relatively weak word, if you think about it. If somebody asked any of your listeners how the relationship was with their significant other, and they said, oh, it's sustainable, would we feel happier or sad for that person? It's not a very positive word. What it means is you're trying to hold on to what you have. And we're suggesting that if we farm differently, we can actually improve what we have. Because the system is based on biology, you literally can have your cake and eat it too. We can produce all the food we want without wearing out the soil, because it's not an industrial model, it's a biological model. Chemistry is involved, but it's not a chemical model, it's a biological model. And biology is a legitimate science that you can study at any university in the country. We all took it in high school, or in grade school we learned something about biology. So it's a true science. The issue we have with biology as farmers and as scientists is that it's a little bit of a messy science. I'm not suggesting that chemistry is easy, because anybody that took a college-level chemistry course knows that it's challenging. But it is a very clean science. By that I mean if you take two chemicals and you mix them together on your desk where you're sitting, and I mix them here on my desk, we're going to get the same reaction. And you're going to get it today, and you're going to get it tomorrow. So that makes chemical agriculture very transferable and transportable. On the other hand, biology is not like that, because I do something today and it doesn't work the same tomorrow. I do something this year, it doesn't work the same as last year, and whatever you do at your desk or your farm isn't going to work exactly the same on my farm, because the weather patterns are different, the topography is different, the soil quality is different, the state of soil health might be different, and so you're going to get slightly different reactions and responses. So we need to fine-tune the biological systems across lots of landscapes, and that's why there's a lot of room for research, a lot of room for input, and a lot of challenges in the short term for some farmers. But I think long term, it's a much more stable, regenerative system, and that's why we focus on the word regeneration and regenerative agriculture.
Well, and part of that, as I understand it, is the role of soil. And that gets into what has been somewhat of a controversy, because we have hydroponic production has been and is recognized as organic because it's not having these synthetic inputs, but it also isn't soil. It's in a substrate that's adding all of these nutrients. And so it's being pointed out that that doesn't make it the same. So again, that's another little element of complexity, I suppose, of explaining why it is that in this food, if it doesn't have the chemicals into the production of the food, but it also doesn't have the soil, why does that matter?
Well, there's some folks don't think it does matter, and then there's some folks who think it does matter, and that's we're doing a lot of science around that, and I think that'll be important to society as a whole as that science unfolds. But in the short term, if you look at what we're doing with our new regenerative organic standard, is we're basing the entire certification process on the USDA's certified organic regulations. But then we're adding some complexity to that, because we really want to talk about soil health, we want to talk about animal welfare, and we want to talk a little bit about social justice and the way farm workers are treated, not just in the United States, but around the globe. Because we recognize that when consumers come to the marketplace to purchase a product, whether it be food or fiber, they come typically with a whole suite of values, not just one value. And if you force people to make a choice across values, for example, a meat product could be certified organic, it could be animal welfare approved. Many consumers say, boy, both those things are important to me. Can't I have a product that has both certifications. And of course, there are those products out there that do that, but the farmers or the producers or the marketers in the supply chain, who are the brands that produce those products, have to get multiple certifications. And so we're looking at one certification that takes care of all of those components that are valuable to customers and consumers in the marketplace. And so it's certified organic. It also improves the health of the soil, which means soil's involved, which means it can't be hydroponically produced under the regenerative organic standard. And then we look at animal welfare and farmer justice and fair labor practices as part of that entire package, again, that are important to those consumers who are buying the product.
Well, there's a lot to read if you're trying to get that all on a label. Will you be having products, say, regenerative on them, on labels? That currently they have the organic certification, but will there be a regenerative organic certification mark on consumer products?
Yes, there will. There will be and I would ask any of your listeners that are interested to go to Regenerative Organic Alliance. Again, Google search that. Regenerative Organic Alliance is a separate nonprofit that we set up with several brands. I believe we now have 42 major brands across the country who are looking at putting that label on their product. And they probably, in most cases, will be replacing the organic seal with the Regenerative Organic logo. They could use them side by side. We've been working, I won't say daily, but we've been working routinely in corresponding with the USDA to ensure that we don't run afoul of the federal regulations and the federal laws that own and maintain the word organic. We're so simply changing the structure of the marketing to include those other values that, again, we think are important. Consumers have indicated are important, and in particular the ones about soil health, animal welfare, and fair labor.
You know, in a way, I don't envy consumers. I am a consumer, and I do a lot of our shopping. So I go to the supermarket, and there's a few things I have to look for. I'm lucky to find, I might want a canned product because I want it preserved, but I might be lucky to find two of, you know, in fact, I was looking for white corn for a recipe, a shoe peg corn. Well, you're lucky to find one. You have to go to three stores to find them. And then some other products that are more common, you end up having, you know, seven or eight brands, and now, and there's a lot of description there too. So I sympathize with other consumers too that try to do that job of shopping and say something is important to me, and if they want to buy organic, they look for as much of it as they can get, and they don't get 100% perhaps. And then there's these other terms. It's a lot to keep up on.
It is, and I agree with you. I mean, all of us are consumers in one way, shape, or form of food products, fiber products, and we go out there and purchase them, and there is some confusion in the marketplace. You alluded to that earlier when you mentioned words like natural or, there's a bunch of them that are out there. You know, it's almost like lightning proof. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means whatever you choose it to mean. And so I think there's a real emphasis by certain brands to capitalize on that confusion and try to claim a place in the marketplace that doesn't adhere to a strict standard like organic or like the regenerative organic label will be, and simply tries to greenwash whatever it is they're doing or ride on the coattails of those words to try and capture consumer dollars. And over time, I think that's going to, those things will be weeded out, and consumers are smart, and they do pay attention, and they are interested in the quality and health of the products that they purchase. And I think at the end, over time, we'll get to where we need to be.
Well, it's, you know, it's like non-GMO. By definition, certified organic, and I suppose certified regenerative organic is non-GMO.
That's correct.
But non-GMO is only non-GMO, which is not that hard to achieve, since there's only about 8 or 10 commodities out of 350 that are GMO, right, that are on the market right now. But it doesn't tell you all the other things, that the other information. So it just looks like this huge job of informing people and making sure that it's easy for them to find out what they need to know. And I would imagine, like you said, they can Google some of these terms, but can they also find information on your website?
Absolutely. They can come to our website, www.rodaleinstitute.org. Google search Rodale Institute. We pop up everywhere. Lots of information there. And if they reach out to us through email or whatever channel they want, we're happy to try to point them in the direction that will help them sort out that complex world of marketing that is out there. You mentioned non-GMO. I mean, look at gluten-free. People recognize that people are trying to avoid gluten. They put gluten-free on things that never even had gluten in it.
That's right.
Just to try to market it. And, you know, I guess you can't blame people for trying to make a dollar and market a product, but by the same token, it can be confusing to some consumers that for various reasons are looking for specific integrity in a product.
Well, and the thing that I take exception with those marketing approaches, it encourages maybe some people taking shortcuts because, you know, a farmer that's decided to go the organic track has taken a long time to get into it and doing so many other things, including paying for certification. If somebody only has to claim natural or something like that, they aren't making near the investment of time and effort and practices that somebody that's certifying is.
I agree. It's a bit ingenuous, something. Yeah, it's disingenuous. That's what I was looking for. A little disingenuous, but it's out there, and people will do that, and we recognize that. And but just because it's hard to educate consumers or hard for consumers to educate themselves, doesn't seem to deter consumers, and doesn't give us an easy way to say, well, we just shouldn't do it because it's hard. We think it is hard. Still worth doing, and I think in the long run, consumers will recognize that, respect it, and as they have done with organic, search that out in the marketplace to bring to their tables and their homes the quality of products that they think are important to them.
Jeff, how long have you been doing this, that you've been involved in the organic movement?
Well, I'm one of those early adopters, and I've been involved. I've worked here at Rodale Institute for 43 years and have my own organic farm at home as well. So I've been involved, I would say, most of my adult life. If it's been focused on organic production and trying to move the organic community in a positive direction.
Well, you're obviously enthusiastic and very committed to it. Explain Rodale Institute.
Well, sure. I mean, in order to talk about Rodale, we really got to go back in history quite a ways, because our founder, J.I. Rodale, was a unique person. He was not a farmer by training. He was a businessman from New York City. In fact, his real name wasn't Rodale. Originally, it was Cohen. And doing business leading up to World War II, back in the 1930s, with a Jewish last name was challenging. So just a little insight into how J.I. Rodale thought was you know, if your name's a problem, change your name. And so he did that, and Rodale is a name that he created. And he created a lot of industries around that, along with his electrical switchgear business that he was in. He created a publishing firm because he really got interested in what was happening to our food production in terms of its ability to maintain or build up the health of the individuals that were consuming the food. So he was really health-minded as he was thinking about food production. And so he was fairly successful at his business ventures, and he ended up purchasing a farm. And in order to farm, you know, when you don't know what you're doing, you ask experts, and he asked experts, and they told him about all of the inputs that he should be bringing onto the farm to produce food crops, and it all made sense to him until they started explaining what these inputs were, and it was salt-based fertilizers and pesticides. He said, I don't understand how the soil transforms these materials into healthy food. I don't understand that. Explain that to me. And of course, they couldn't, because the presumption is if pesticides were used to make people healthy, then the more we use, the healthier we'd get, and that's just not the truth. And so he said, well, then let's not use those to produce food on my farm, and he began exploring the ideas and the concepts that later became known as organic agriculture. as it's being housed by the USDA today. He sort of started doing that back in the late 1930s, and by 1942 he had produced a publication that was called Organic Farming and Gardening Magazine. He used some of the proceeds from that to do his own research, but really wanted to encourage land-grant universities to do some of that research. That didn't pan out for him because they weren't really interested in doing that, and so he created his own nonprofit in 1947, which is now the Rodale Institute. So we've been around officially since 1947, doing research and education in the area of organic food production.
And explain where you are to people that, well, in Pennsylvania, but what part of Pennsylvania are you in now?
Well, we're located in southeastern Pennsylvania. That's our world headquarters, and that's where our research facility is. But we operate around the country in all four corners of the United States, and then we also have some international projects that have been working around the world. So it's quite diverse operation that we manage here.
Now, when you're saying in different parts of the United States, do you actually have research going on farmland in different corners of the United States?
Well, one of the things that we've been really good at is building partnerships and relationships. And so we have projects that we work with land-grant universities across the United States. And then just recently, we opened a research station in outside of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. That's brand new. All we have in the ground right now is cover crops, as we're seeking some new staff to be there. And it won't be long, we'll be announcing something that we're doing down in the southern part of the United States as well. So we are branching out right now into managing our own research stations, but for many years we've been working with existing research stations to sort of, kind of leverage our work with theirs so that we don't duplicate research efforts, but work together in partnership with land grants to move the concepts that we're espousing with organic agriculture out into the broader farm community. So if you go to almost every land-grant university in the country today, you'll find some amount of organic research. So we know we're having impact, and that's really what it's all about for a nonprofit like us. Organic, since the early 80s, and officially since 2002, the word is owned by and managed by the USDA as it applies to food and fiber production. And that was a process that took many years to take shape, but the Organic Food Production Act of 1990 really brought that to bear, and we've been working for decades now with the USDA to design, maintain, and have a dynamic impact through the National Organic Standards Board on how that plays out in the marketplace.
Well, you know, it's almost 30 years, isn't it? And at the time when organic certification went through, people were calling foods all sorts of things, and there really wasn't any legal definition. And organic's one of the few I can think of where it really stands for something, that it's backed up, that it has to be certified if you're claiming that it's organic. It has law behind it, whereas natural and some other things are just, you know, guidelines. But help me if I'm missing something.
No, you are not missing anything. You are absolutely correct. It's one of the really few times in the history of the country where a particular enterprise, in this case farming, has reached out to the federal government and asked for more regulation, not less regulation. You know, typically we're petitioning the government to give us less regulation and allow us to more freedom for business. But in this particular case, what you said is true. Many people were looking at the consumer demand for organic and the growth in that industry and laying claim to that organic label without really going through any sort of a third-party certification process and without having the USDA involved in setting a particular standard. It was becoming more and more difficult for farmers who were following a certification process to lay claim to that in the marketplace.
So I could sit down and say, if I have a farm and I've got, I don't know, 100 acres that I want to go organic with, and we get the process to phase it in. What's it going to look like? I mean, compared to my neighbor that is conventionally farming, and I'm right beside him, and I got my 100 acres and their 100 acres. I mean, what are the basic practices that are that make it so different from the non-organic farming or the conventional farming?
Well, the big difference, of course, that most people know or recognize is that once you're an organic farmer as compared to a conventional farmer, you're no longer going to be relying on synthetic chemical inputs, and you're going to be focusing your energy on more biologically envisioned systems. So you're going to be looking at soil health as a key component to what you're doing on your farm, and looking at how changes in your production strategy can improve the health of your soil so that the soil feeds the plant instead of the, if it's a cropping situation, it's different in livestock, so that the soil is feeding the crop and you're feeding and managing the soil versus looking at inputs that go directly into the crop. So for many farmers, what's going to look different is on the surface of the farm this time of the year, you're not going to have as much brown land, and you're going to have a lot more green land, which means you've got a cover crop growing on the land. So we're trying to cover the soil with something green and growing 12 months out of the year. Now we're starting to see a lot of conventional farmers pick up on some of these technologies as well. So the line gets blurred between conventional and organic as we simply just look at the surface of the landscape. But once you get underground, you start to see more carbon sequestration, more biological activity, more earthworms, farmers will say, and certainly more diversity. Really difficult for an organic farmer, probably impossible, to sit in Iowa and grow corn for 25 years straight. You just wouldn't be able to get that certified. So you're going to diversify your crop. If you're a monocrop farm, you're going to diversify into some other different crops within a rotation to support the whole operation. Of course, if it's tree fruits like avocados or apples or peaches or something like that, you're going to manage your orchard floor differently. You're going to manage your insect and disease pests differently. And in some cases, you may even be replacing some of your plant material with disease-resistant cultivars, and we see farmers doing that. On a livestock operation, you're not going to be using antibiotics, and you're probably going to be changing some of your housing around to accommodate more space for animals, whether that's poultry or hogs. If it's beef or dairy, you're going to have to get those animals out on pasture so that they have access to the outdoors and green grass. So, yeah, there are some differences, but I think what's really interesting and what farmers report back to us is that they still get to drive the same color tractor, wear the same brand of hat, grow the same, produce the same crop or the same animals. They're just doing it in a slightly different way that is recognized not only by the USDA, but really by consumers, and that's really what it's all about.
When you look down the road the next 5 years, what's getting you excited about the future?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things that excite me about the future. Probably the most important is just the incredible energy and capacity that young people are bringing to the farm today. We see more and more young people wanting to get into agriculture and wanting to get into organic and regenerative organic agriculture, not necessarily looking at conventional production as their future. We're looking at young consumers. You know, the marketplace is being driven by millennials and Generation Z, and those folks are incredibly bright, well-educated, very used to technology, smartphone technology, very used to looking up information, having lots of information at their fingertips, and wanting to know more about the product. So I'm energized by young people and just the enthusiasm that they have for producing agricultural products and consuming them as well.
Well, I know some of those people are listening to our podcast. We hear from them from all over the world, actually. And some I know are working in another job right now and making their plans because they would rather try to transition and get started in farming. How can they reach out to you? I mean, if it's somebody that's saying, gee, I want to go this direction, is there somebody they can call or someplace they can connect with Rodale so that they can be either encouraged or at least get their questions answered?
Sure. Our first stopping point is always to have people send an email. If they go on our website, it's called info at. You send it to info at Rodale Institute, and the folks here in our office will they scan that on a daily basis and send those requests for information off to the staff member that's most will be of most use. We have a consulting arm here at the Institute. We have the National Organic Farmers Association is hosted here by Rodale Institute. So we work on policy decisions in Washington, working with policymakers to give them the information that organic farmers in the organic community want them to have or think they need to have. We have, like I said, we have a consulting arm, so we can do everything from give advice over the telephone to literally send a person to a farm to help walk people through the process. Some of that is a fee-for-service situation, as you can imagine. Right now, a great example is here in the state of Pennsylvania. Our governor and our Secretary of Agriculture have gotten behind the organic movement to the point where they have put some dollars in place to support the consultancy that we are making available to farmers. So in Pennsylvania right now, for the next year or so, farmers can get that service for free from the state of Pennsylvania to help farmers transition. So we're seeing that happening across the country where more and more folks are getting involved, more politicians and government officials are saying, hey, this is not only good for the soil, it's good for the economy of our state. How do we get behind that and support those farmers that want to make a difference, want to transition, or maybe just want to explore that option as a possibility on their farm and look at what those opportunities might look like on their farm?
Well, you know, you and I talked about this briefly right after we heard Senator Stabenow talk about really bipartisan efforts. And I sure felt heartened by the fact that there's something going on in Washington that's bipartisan, and it seems like she was able to reach out and get things accomplished in the Farm Bill and seemed to be very optimistic that there's more that can be done in the future that support the kind of directions that you're talking about, and that's exciting.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. It's a food and farm issue, and that's important to all of us, no matter which side of the aisle you sit on. So it really is important to all of us. I think the Organic Trade Association says that 80% of us as Americans have eaten something organic in the last 6 months, and it means that all of us understand something about organic, have some sort of a perception of what that is or what it means, and want to support it in some way, shape, or form. And that's just growing by leaps and bounds. And we really believe that American production agriculture is lagging behind the rest of the world a little bit, and we need to work to catch up because our capacity to do a great job is far better than any other nation in the world, and we can do it, and we will do it, and that's exciting to me.
Well, Jeff, there's no doubt in my mind that as we do catch up, that Rodale and your work will be out there in front, and we're grateful for that, and I'm also grateful for your being on Farm to Table Talk. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to chat with you, and hopefully your listeners glean something out of this that they find worthwhile. And if we pique their interest even just a little bit, I hope they'll explore our website and Rodale Institute. Our farm is open to the public. We get 15,000 to 20,000 visitors a year. I would encourage any of them to come to our doors and see what we're doing firsthand. Everyone's welcome.
Well, I'm going to try to go there soon.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.